Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for June's Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European Veterinary Specialist in Small Animal Surgery, Laura Cuddy. Thank you, Laura. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Emer, and welcome to you all joining us for this webinar today. And over the next kind of 45 minutes to an hour, we're going to look at penetrating wounds, which are quite a common place finding in both first opinion and emergency practice, as of course they usually happen in emergency scenarios. So the first question to ask is, what defines a penetrating wound? And it could be defined as any wound that disrupts the body surface. So whether that's the skin, so epithelium, or whether it's something that comes through the endothelium, so inside the body, into a body cavity, but goes through the surface and goes into the underlying tissue or into a body cavity. So we could look at these as being either outside in wounds, which are probably the more common ones we see. So for example, the stick impalement in a dog, or they could be inside out wounds, which are a little less common and a little trickier sometimes to figure out. So this is a kebab skewer that had migrated from the stomach and on an echocardiogram is tickling the myocardium, which obviously is a significant problem. So if we were to look at penetrating wounds as a whole, by far the most common ones we probably see every day, whether you're in first opinion, emergency or specialty practice, are going to be fairly straightforward bite wounds. And these can range from lacerations, avulsions, puncture wounds, and they can be fairly significant or they can be fairly minor. And then these wounds can be a bit more complicated if they're also entering a body cavity. So in this cat, for example, we have a rake wound that is entering the thorax. And so this significantly changes how we're going to treat this patient. And similarly, we may have wounds that enter the abdominal cavity and cause eviscerations. And many of these cases, whether they're uncomplicated or complicated bite wounds, have very good outcomes. And so often, if we're dealt with appropriately, we can have excellent prognosis in these patients. However, some of these, especially the more complicated bite wounds, we don't win, and they end up in either euthanasia or death due to sepsis or overwhelming inflammation. It's important to remember, especially outside of the UK, but there are some species of adder in the UK as well, that can also cause penetrating injury. So bite wounds are not just confined to dogs and cats causing them. So this is a case from the States of a crotalid envenomation, and these cause severe tissue necrosis and overwhelming inflammatory cascade activation also. And so these can be quite challenging cases to deal with, even though they might seem like very small penetrating wounds. And of course, we may get other species causing these wounds. And the key here in this alligator bite, not very many patients actually survive alligator bites for the obvious reasons. But the key here is what kind of species of microflora of bugs are in the mouth, because we're going to get quite significant infections from some of these cases. So it's important to consider what species has done the biting in some of these bite wounds. And some of these are self-induced injuries. So this is a tiger who self-mutilated and, of course, now has lost his beautiful tail. And so certainly some of these cases can be behavioral issues also. And lastly, of course, they're not just bite wounds. And so especially in the UK, there's a fair amount of stick injuries, so cervical stick injuries or pharyngeal stick injuries from people throwing sticks. It depends geographically where you are. It's not really seen in many other places because people don't throw sticks. You can also see, again, geographic dependent. This is an animal control dart for a large animal that was shot into a dog. And then, of course, we can see arrows and gunshots into certain patients as well. And again, this tends to be geographic. A lot of these pictures are from the States of the ballistic injuries. So what we're going to cover over the next 40 minutes or so, we're going to look mostly at uncomplicated bite wounds, because the tenets of wound care that we're going to talk about in that section really can be applied to any of the wounds in the further sections. They just have some extra special considerations to go with them. Then we'll talk a little bit about complicated bite wounds, so those that may enter a body cavity or the neck or have other significant injury. Other penetrating injuries, so for example, arrow injuries, gunshot injuries, and other ballistic injuries. And then briefly try to sum it all up at the very end. So let's start with uncomplicated bite wounds. Bite wounds, we all see them every day. They form a fair amount of cases that present as trauma cases. In the States, at least, we think they comprise about 1% of all emergency room visits are bite wounds. When I first went to the States as an intern, I was told there was a BDLD coming in and I didn't know what that was, but it's usually big dog, little dog. So it's a little dog may have incited the fight. So a young, intact male, small breed dog is often the victim. And the big dog just has his patience tested a little bit and then might pick up and shake the small breed dog, resulting in not just punctures, but lacerations, avulsions of the subcutaneous tissue, and then underlying injuries also. The issue with dog bites is the force that their jaw can exert is quite significant. So we know it's not just a simple puncture. They shear when they compress. They have tensile forces, and then they have quite significant compressive forces also. So a dog jaw exerts a huge amount more pressure than a human jaw can, so up to 450 pounds per square inch. And so what we end up with are a combination of lacerations, punctures, and avulsions. And so some of the more straightforward ones are simple punctures, but oftentimes we do have these lacerations and avulsions also. If we look at where these bite wounds tend to happen on the body, there are some studies suggesting in dogs they're going to be in multiple sites, especially if it's a small breed dog. So in half of the cases, they're not just going to be localized to one area. And so the most common areas are going to be the thorax, the extremities, the head and neck, followed by the abdomen, and occasionally the perineum, like you can see in this dog here. Often when they're running away, they get bitten in the perineum. In cats, it tends to be more a single site, and it tends to be the back and the thorax affected more commonly. The key part is that dog and cat skin compared to human skin is very viscoelastic, and we all know this. It's very forgiving for wound reconstruction. However, that also means if they're picked up and shaken, that we can have quite significant avulsion of the skin from the subcutaneous tissue. What that also means is that a very innocuous looking puncture wound on the surface often has quite significant subcutaneous trauma underneath. So it's a tip of the iceberg is what we would generally refer to it as. And the other key part is that often there's deep inoculation of oral flora from the biter and contaminants to the bite from the bitee. So especially if you have a long-haired dog, when you explore these wounds, you'll often find hair, grass, soil embedded down deep in the subcutaneous tissue. Now, if you were to just leave that puncture wound because you think it looks fairly innocuous, that will turn into a problem later on. So that's why we advise exploring all these wounds to look for that deep contaminated tissue. If these bite wounds are allowed to progress, we can see systemic effects, typically with delayed intervention. And so we can see necrosis of the tissue, and then when you have bacteria involved, and then we end up with stimulation of the inflammatory and coagulation cascades. And this can result in quite significant dysregulation of inflammation. And so this leads to our complicated cases where we can have significant changes leading to euthanasia or death. So just a reminder about the inflammatory response. And so we generally start with the systemic inflammation in these cases. And then if they get infected, we can end up with sepsis. In many of or some of these cases, and they're not that common, we can end up with severe sepsis, septic shock, or multiple organ dysfunction syndrome if they're allowed to progress beyond a certain point. So uncomplicated bite wounds, I like to think to myself that there's a fairly logical way to treat them. And so the first thing we're going to do is assess and stabilize the patient as we would with any trauma patient. We're going to, importantly in these cases, prevent further contamination of the wounds. And so it's quite common for the bacteria that end up infecting these wounds to come from our hospital environments, especially if you're working in specialty practice. And so it's very important to limit contamination of these wounds. When the patient is stable and we figured out that there isn't a whole pile else going on, for example, it doesn't extend into the thorax or abdomen, or there's not something else more life-threatening going on, then we're going to try to assess and explore the wounds. We're going to remove debris and debride the wounds, any kind of contaminated, dead, necrotic tissue, perform copious lavage, get a wound culture after copious lavage, give broad-spectrum empiric antibiotics, and this could be argued in some of these wounds where you can excise the contaminated tissue. You could argue, do you need to give antibiotics in these cases? apply an appropriate wound dressing or drain if you're going to close the wound. And if you are doing wound dressings, then at a later date, consider a delayed primary closure. And so we're going to go through each of these steps one by one and expand on them a little bit to give ourselves a bit of a protocol as to how to deal with these cases. So let's start with step one. Let's assess and stabilize the patient. So this goes for any trauma patient. We need to identify and treat life-threatening problems before we get too focused on the wounds. The wounds are an issue. We need to make sure we're not contaminating them, but we need to make sure there's not something more significant going on. So, for example, is there a central nervous system injury? Can the animal ventilate appropriately or do we need to intervene? Is there severe hemorrhage? Is the patient in hypovolemic shock? Do we need to resuscitate volume-wise? Is the patient already septic if we have a delayed presentation? And does it have distributive shock? And do we need to intervene in other ways? And so some examples of some of the steps that I take, and of course, this is not the time or place really to expand on these, but just briefly, we want to check when they come in their vital parameters. We might want to run an ECG if they're a trauma patient. We certainly probably want a blood pressure unless they're looking very stable. We might want an SpO2 to make sure that they're oxygenating appropriately. We want to get an IV catheter in most likely. We want to start IV fluids. And then we want to do a very thorough physical exam to see if we can identify other issues going on. You may want to provide supplemental oxygen if indicated. You may want to provide some emergency blood work, especially if there's a delayed presentation, also to check and see what kind of response we have. And then, of course, provide analgesia. My preference with analgesia is to provide a full mu agonist. And the reason for this is that at least we can reverse it if the animal suddenly begins to be unable to ventilate appropriately or something else is going on. We can at least reverse a full mu agonist. So, for example, methadone is often my first choice for this. I like to, if I can, get the physical exam done before I give analgesia, just so I can fully assess, for example, orthopedic and neurologic conditions. But of course, that depends on where you are in the whole scheme of things. So let's move on to the more wound-focused areas. So firstly, we want to prevent further contamination. And it's very easy to forget that these patients have very large open areas often. And as I mentioned previously, often if we get infections in these wounds 3 to 5 days afterwards, when we culture them, they often are hospital-acquired bugs, and they're not necessarily the flora that were inoculated at the time of the bite. And so it's really important from the get-go to try to prevent inoculation of these bacteria into the wounds. So the first point that I'm quite strict about is everybody handling these patients must wear gloves, which seems like a fairly minor thing, but it's quite common that people forget and have their hands on them. So everyone has to wear gloves. While you're assessing the patient, I do recommend covering the wounds temporarily. And this can be something as simple as just gauze or non-adherent dressing, and just while you're getting a grip of are there other life-threatening injuries you need to deal with first. Of course, you're going to need to control any profuse bleeding. It's not that common that we see them come in with profuse hemorrhage, but if you do, just direct pressure is the key. Try not to use any tourniquets unless you really have to. Direct pressure is usually enough. You may at this point want to do further diagnostics. Again, if you're not sure if it's involving a body cavity or you're not sure about what else is going on with the patient as regards other injury. So you may want to perform radiographs. You may want to do a fast scan or a full ultrasound of the chest and abdomen. You may want to perform syntesis of the body cavity to assess, is it just blood? Is there urine somewhere in the abdomen, for example? Some people suggest a diagnostic peritoneal lavage. However, at this point, if you have a very low volume of peritoneal fluid to the point where you can't access it, I'd be inclined to monitor more so. At some point, you might want to do a retrograde cysteurethrogram, but I wouldn't be jumping into that at this point. I would want to get the patient stable. As long as if we know there's urine in there, we can drain that by the abdomen and deal with that later on if there is a rupture of the urinary tract. Just one other point which may become more pertinent as time goes on is to check the rabies status. Having worked in the States, it's very important if you know the rabies status of the biter, otherwise these patients might need to be quarantined, and of the bitee. So you need to know the vaccination status of the bitee. And then obviously we would like to get these ideas between gross visualization and radiographs. We'd like to have an idea of what other injuries are going on, but it's very important to remember that these only tell you so much. And we know from retrospective studies that looking at radiographs and looking at wounds, for example, chest wounds, they have limited use in knowing whether there is penetration of the body cavity or not. So take some of these findings with a little bit of a pinch of salt. So now we're going to assess the wounds. And so ideally the patient is as stable as we can get them to this point, but we don't want to delay looking at the wounds either. For example, this wound we can see in this picture is very heavily contaminated with grass, soil and debris, and we can't leave that more than an hour or two before we intervene, because we know there's a golden period of less than 6 hours where we really should be intervening in these wounds. And so as stable as we can get them. So what I try to do is just briefly have a look before anesthesia sedation. You might need to muzzle these patients in order to at least just get a brief look as to see on the outside what you think you're going to be dealing with. But really for a thorough explore, you often need a general anesthetic. And in these patients, if they are compromised, a general anesthetic is often a little bit safer than using just medetomidine and, for example, butorphanol as a sedation, or medetomidine and methadone, for example, as a sedation. Often general anesthesia is a little bit safer, at least you can control the airway and do a thorough explore of the wounds. So firstly, we're going to clip and clean, and it sounds fairly simple. It is fairly simple, but just some key points. When you're looking at these wounds and you're trying to say to yourself, how am I going to get from the picture at the top of the slide to the picture at the bottom of the slide, some tips and tricks we have is the key part really is to protect the wound from the surrounding hair and debris to try and keep the wound bed as clean as you can. So either pop in a moist, sterile gauze, either with saline or simply tap water if it's a very extensive wound, or you can fill the wounds just with lubricating jelly. And what that'll do is when you're clipping the hair, it'll trap the hair in either the gauze or the jelly, and then you can wash it away at the end. So we're trying to prevent further contamination of the wound. You want to clip the hair surrounding the wounds and clip extensively. You want a very, very wide clip, because at some point if you're going to have to reconstruct this wound, you're going to want to clip it anyway. So clip more than you need to, and then have a look. You might expose more puncture wounds that you hadn't seen before when you've done your clipping. You want to vacuum the hair out as best you can, and then you want to lavage out the area around the skin, the surrounding skin, using Hibis scrub. So either 4% chlorhexidine detergent solution. It's important you don't get that into the wound bed because it's quite toxic to fibroblasts. So ideally, you're just prepping the surrounding skin. So for example, in this area here, we would be prepping these areas of skin and trying not to get the chlorhexidine solution into the actual wound bed. What about using povidone iodine? You can use it, however, it's not very active in the face of organic debris, and so it wouldn't be my first choice. I would prefer to use chlorhexidine solutions in this scenario. And then you're going to want to gently wipe off that solution from the skin with your sterile saline and lavage the KY jelly, or remove your gauze out of the wound also. You can classify the severity of the wounds at this point. Now that you've clipped them and you've had a look at them, you can try to classify the severity. So there is a paper looking at how you do this back from 2001. And I have to say, it's not something I use clinically. So be aware it exists. You might see some people using this classification scheme, but it's not really used very widely. A puncture would be defined as less than a centimeter, a laceration over a centimeter. A class 1 wound wouldn't penetrate the dermis, so we typically don't even see these wounds. They're very superficial epidermal wounds. A class 2 wound is a laceration that penetrates the dermis. Interestingly, a class 3 is a puncture, so that would be considered worse, that penetrates the dermis. And then class 4 is where we have either a laceration or a puncture, but we also have tissue avulsion or dead space underneath, and that's obviously more concerning. And then lastly, it's already turned into an abscess, so it's a wound that hasn't been treated appropriately, or there's been delayed treatment, and we've turned into an infected scenario already. So let's talk about wound exploration now that we've assessed them. So typically what we're going to want to do once we've clipped and cleaned is drape off the area if we can, and then use a sterile probe to go into puncture wounds and see how far they extend. based on how far they extend, I'll often open the puncture wounds using a scalpel blade so I can assess the underlying tissue. So extend them as far as I need to have a look at that pocket that's been created with that puncture. If I have two punctures in fairly close proximity and they seem to connect when I put the probe between them, then I'm going to extend an incision, just like in this picture here. I'm going to extend an incision between the two puncture wounds so I can assess the underlying tissue. Be careful with the orientation of how you do that. Ideally, you would extend it from dorsal to ventral so that you can allow drainage from that area quite easily, but sometimes that's not feasible. And then the key is to follow the wound to its deepest extent. As we talked about, I think the key problem here is often the animal's own hair, which has been driven into the wound with the bite wound, and inoculation, obviously, of oral flora from the biter. And so it's important to get down to the deepest extent to make sure there isn't a tooth or hair or something down in that vicinity. So now we need to decide, is the wound infected? And the key part here is the difference between contamination and infection. So contamination, there's an infectious agent present in the wound. However, it has not colonized yet being the operative word. So we know every bite wound is contaminated because some bacteria from the mouth have gotten into the wound bed. But if it's been dealt with quickly and it's dealt with efficiently, then yes, the wound's contaminated, but it's not infected yet. Infection is when an infectious agent actually has invaded and multiplies in the wound. We generally say about 6 hours after inoculation, although that does decrease depending on the amount of debris there is, so it could be sooner. So it's important to remember, if you see a bite wound quickly, it's more likely it's contaminated, it's not infected yet. But if it's not dealt with, it'll become infected. So how do we know if a bite wound is infected? Well, we can go based on history and based on how long ago the bite wound happened. But if we don't know that, then the key criteria we use is one major sign of pus, fever, or leukocytosis. So, for example, we can see pus straining from this wound here. And we also have to see three or more minor signs. So erythema or reddening of the surrounding skin, again, like we can see in this picture. Edema, subcutaneous emphysema, tissue necrosis, or malodor. So theoretically, these are criteria you have to meet in order for a wound to be determined to be infected. So how does a contaminated wound go to being an infected wound? And so that depends on the patient's general health. It depends on where they've been bitten. Is it an area, for example, around the perineum that has a decent chance of getting infected? How bad is the tissue trauma? Obviously, the worse the trauma, the higher the chance. What bacteria have been inoculated? For example, that alligator bite I showed you has an extremely high chance of getting infected due to the flora in the mouth. And I think the most important one that we deal with is delayed treatment. So either the owner delays or they get presented and it looks like a simple puncture and just the outside of the wound is dealt with. And then by the time we get to definitive treatment, it's already become infected. So we'll touch on this a little bit more later when we talk about culturing these wounds. So then we're going to want to debride the wound. And so we like to do layered sharp debridement. I like to do that with a scalpel blade. And what we're assessing is any tissue green, grey, or black. They're generally bad colours. Red, purple may survive. And so it might be that if we have some purple tissue and we can't sacrifice it, it's important tissue, well, we might say we'll leave it and look at it again tomorrow. So put on an appropriate wound dressing and look at it again. And it might need to be debrided at some point. But certainly anything green, grey, or black probably needs to come out. So remove that dead and devitalized tissue. The key here is also to try to remove as much debris as you can. And some tip I have for this is that if you have the sub-Q is severely contaminated with dirt and debris, then you can actually remove a thin layer of the subcutaneous tissue rather than trying to pick all the bits of dirt out of it. The key here is to remember that it will slow down wound healing if you take a lot of it. If you take all of the subcutaneous tissue out in that area, especially in cats, there are some studies to show it will delay wound healing quite significantly. So just be careful. It's a balance taking the debris out versus what it's going to do with the wound ultimately. So lavage, and one of the questions we get asked a lot is, does it matter what you lavage the wound with? I typically default to sterile saline. You could argue that that is actually a little bit hypertonic to the cells, and so it may not be the best solution. So some people say, based on experimental studies, that using lactated Ringer solution or Hartmann solution may be preferred. But again, this is in vitro work looking at cells. You can also use tap water. And again, that's hypotonic, so it might cause cell lysis. And so the key part here is depends on how badly contaminated the wound is. If it's a very badly contaminated wound, to start with, we might pop them on one of these dirty sinks that we can actually lavage out with tap water first, and then go to more sterile solution as we move on through the irrigation. Ultimately, it doesn't really matter what you use as long as you use enough of it. Some people use a chlorhexidine solution. It's important to differentiate this from Hibis scrub, which is detergent solution. Chlorhexidine solution, or Hibitane, is simply chlorhexidine mixed with a diluent, so there's no detergent in it. So it's not as harmful, and it's a much lower concentration than the detergent solution. And again, there's, you could argue, is that the right thing to do or not? And again, can you use povidone iodine? I wouldn't recommend it. Again, we know there's no efficacy with organic matter, and it also doesn't have residual activity in the wound bed, whereas we do get that if you do end up using chlorhexidine solution. So to boil it down simply, I would go with either sterile saline, LRS, or if you have a very badly contaminated wound, start with tap water and then move on to your other solutions. What about other solutions? You will see quite a few solutions marketed by companies, and you need to be a bit careful about some of them. Some of them may cause chemical injury and inhibit wound healing, for example, hypochlorous acid or Dakin's solution. There are some newer solutions out there right now which do claim to reduce biofilm formation, so you might consider some of these, for example, Prontosan. It's unclear whether the cost of these solutions, for example, versus tap water, really is a benefit for their use. So how are we actually going to perform the lavage? You just need to do a lot of it. So it is true here that dilution is the solution to pollution. You can't really lavage too much. Just be careful you're not making the patient very cold, especially if it's a small patient. So copious lavage is in order for these wounds. Now, ideally, we would generate 7 to 8 pounds per square inch of pressure when we're performing the lavage. However, when you go back to literature and try and find out where this number came from, it's very difficult. It's pretty much a number that was decided on and with very little evidence. But we think it's about right to not drive more debris into the tissue, but try and get debris out of the tissue. So too high a pressure and you risk driving it further down, too low and you won't get any out. So the best way and the most simple way to generate this is to use a 16 gauge needle on the end of an extension set, use a litre of fluids, and set a pressure bag at 300 millimetres of mercury, and that generates your 7 to 8 PSI. We know this based on the study that came out of Colorado State University back in 2010, looking at what pressures you can generate with different techniques. And so you can see the tap generates very little pressure, a bulb syringe, again, very little, a bottle with holes, which some people like, again, very little pressure, only 4 PSI. We can see the one that I use here, the 16-gauge needle, with the pressure bag at 300 millimetres of mercury, you get about 7 to 8. A syringe and needle, which a lot of people use, a lot of us were taught 18 to 19 gauge needle with a 35 or 60 mil syringe, that actually can generate up to 17 or 18 PSI, which may be too high. You might be driving stuff into the tissue. And then lastly, you can get some high pressure pulsatile devices, which go at high pressure, obviously, as well. So this is where I use this technique from. Now, what about wound culture? We already talked about, is the wound infected or contaminated? Regardless of what it looks like, I will always perform the culture after I have done my lavage and debridement. And the reason for that is we're going to have a whole pile of contaminants from the mouth, from the soil, from grass in the wound. And so if we were to culture it, which seems to be the more logical thing to do, but if we were to culture it before doing lavage and debridement, we would simply just culture a whole pile of contaminants and not really know what to do with those results. And so it's preferable to get the wound as clean as you can, and then whatever bug is left behind at that point may become the infecting bug later on. So we know from some studies that if you culture an acute uninfected wound before you do lavage and debridement, it's not going to be the bug that ends up causing the infection later on. So it is important to do it after lavage and debridement. And I would always look, especially in bite wounds, for aerobic and anaerobic cultures, because we often do have anaerobes inoculated in these cases. If we have a look at what are the most common wound bacteria isolated, we can see that many of these wounds do culture positive, so between 85 and 95% will culture positive. And it's typically a mixture of aerobic and anaerobic bacteria, so Streps, Pasteurella, Staphylococcus species. However, if you look at how many of those wounds will go on to become infected, it's only around 20% of them will become clinically infected after that fact. The key thing, which we briefly touched on earlier, is that delayed intervention increases your risk of infection. So the longer the time from the bite wound to presentation to the clinic, the higher the chance of infection. So it's important to intervene with these cases early. So that leads to the question, should we be prescribing empiric antibiotic therapy or not? I personally would for bite wounds, because we know, especially with cats, that we have some nasty bacteria in there. So typically I do. Ideally, you'd get antibiotics in less than 3 hours from a bite wound if you happen to see them in that time period. And if it's significant wounds, ideally you go IV. You want a broad spectrum antibiotic that also hits anaerobes. So personally, I wouldn't be choosing, for example, a fluoroquinolone by itself, because that's not going to tackle anaerobes. So you want something that's, for example, like amoxicillin clavulanate, cephalosporins, or if you have a fractious animal that they're not going to be able to get antibiotics into, you might consider long-acting antibiotic therapy. The key here is to get your culture back. Hopefully you'll have a preliminary culture back within 48 hours. And based on that, you need to adjust what you're giving as regards antibiotics. The key part, though, here also is to assess the wound. If the wound is looking better on the antibiotics and the treatment you've done and it's improving, you may not want to necessarily change the antibiotic unless it's very off on the culture and susceptibility. So now wound dressings, and this is a fairly controversial area as regards what wound dressing you should do. This is solely my preference and personal opinion. There are a lot of people who don't like these dressings, but for bite wounds, I do like them, and that's the wet to dry dressing. And the reason I like it is that it goes on and does non-selective but mechanical debridement. So I know in the first time I debride this wound, I'll get as much of the debris as I can out. However, I'm not going to get it all. And so by putting in the wet to dry dressing, leaving it for 24 hours and then taking it out, you do need sedation to take it off because it is painful. It'll strip some of the underlying tissue and take any more debris and necrotic tissue off with it. So it's quite a quick way to get wounds looking healthier more quickly. However, it is non-selective mechanical debridement, so it will take healthy tissue too. And that's why some people really don't like these dressings. For this dressing, you can use either sterile saline, you can use hypertonic saline, or you can use dextrose. I typically just use regular sterile saline. You want to pack it into all corners of the wound, but prevent it from touching the skin around the wound because we don't want to macerate it. And then you want to put a dry gauze or a lap sponge on top and then secure the dressing in place. And as I mentioned, they need to be changed at least every 24 hours. So that means they need to be either sedated or undergo a general anesthesia every 24 hours to do this dressing, because it does hurt to take it out. It allows you, though, to perform more debridement every 24 hours if you're doing layered debridement. To secure the dressing, we can use on extremities modified Robert Jones bandages, and that's quite simple. But if we have tricky areas, a key or a nice point is to use a tie-over dressing. And that's where we form suture loops in the skin around the wound. We put in our primary layer. So if we have a dirty wound that we're continuing to debride, maybe a wet to dry, if it's a healthy granulation bed, we'll move to something non-adherent and kinder to the tissue. Then we put the lap sponge on top, and then we're going to use either just ties from surgical masks, are usually a nice way to do it, and connect the loops up to hold the dressing in place. So it's a nice, simple, cheap technique to keep dressings in areas that otherwise would be very tricky to dress. Now, a lot of people ask, well, do I need to do the wound dressing or can I simply close the bite wound? And I would say it's important to remember, as we've discussed, that all of these wounds are either contaminated or dirty. And so should you primarily close them? You could think about it if you've been able to excise the bite wound. So there are some circumstances, especially because dog skin is quite loose and forgiving, where you can simply excise the bite wound tract and then close the resultant bigger wound you've made. And that's okay. But would I primarily close a bite wound without doing that? No, I wouldn't, because the chances of infection are fairly high. So my advice is, if you are in doubt, small wounds can be left open to heal by second intention, and large wounds can be closed over a drain, or you simply continue to dress the wound and then do a delayed primary closure 3 to 5 days later when the wound bed is very healthy. And so that's generally how I approach these wounds. And then what about drains? Well, if you decide to primarily close the wound, you might consider placing a drain. And so many people have used these Penrose drains, which are passive drains, and they're nice and cheap and cheerful, and you can send the patients home with them. Just some technical points about putting them in. There are two errors in each of these pictures. So we can see here, we have the drain exiting through the wound incision, and that's not a good idea. We want to exit through a separate stab incision. So it's nice that it's gravity dependent, so the location as regards gravity is good, but ideally it would be exiting somewhere here or here, not through the actual incision itself. Error number two is this one here, where we see a through and through Penrose drain. Remember, these act simply by wicking bacteria and debris and fluid out through the wound along the outside of the drain. And so if you have an ingress port here and an egress here, you're simply going to wick bacteria in and into the wound and then back out this wound here. So ideally, you do not do that. You just have a single stab incision separate to the wound if you're going to do it. The other key is, especially if they're in the hospital, is always to bandage that drain exit port to prevent an ascending infection, number one. And number two, I don't want these guys dripping fluid around the hospital in their kennels or going out for a walk. So if these are in the hospital, I always have these Penrose drains bandaged. My preference for those reasons is to go for an active drain. And so typically we would go for a Jackson Pratt and grenade drain. And these, because they're active drains, are less prone to problems. You're not going to have wound fluid leaking out of them. And ideally, you have less chance of nosocomial infection with them. So let's just briefly look at a case example while we have that fresh in our heads. So this is Callie, a 2-year-old female spayed beagle mix who presented to me after being bitten by a pit bull puppy and quite severe bite wounds. And unfortunately, this happened out in a grassy area. So if we have a look at these wounds, we can see that there's quite extensive debris, grass, soil, hair, all sorts of things inside in these wounds. And so the first thing I did was follow those steps. She didn't have any other injuries. And so based on screening, she had chest x-ray, she had blood work, she had abdominal scan, everything's fine. And so we went ahead and clipped, cleaned, and did what we could with these wounds. So very wide clip and clean. And you can see that's after the first clean. And you can see we still have quite a bit of debris in the subcutaneous tissue. And so I said to myself, there's no way I can close these wounds the way they are. And I can't do any more with the subcutaneous tissue at this point. And so I elected to dress these wounds. This is the cleanest I was able to get them. And I elected to dress these wounds using tie-over dressings. So you can see the suture loops around the edge here, which we were using to apply tie-over dressings. So wet to dry dressings. But as we can see, quite extensive wounds over the neck and thorax. And so she had these dressings for 2 days. And this is at day 2 and looking fairly okay, getting healthier. And then we got to the point in day 3 where we said we have a huge amount of skin open here, and we know skin is a large organ. It's essentially a big burns victim. We need to get this skin closed. So we went ahead and closed the wounds over some drains. So we can see here an active drain, so a Jackson Pratt and grenade drain here. And she ended up in intensive care. And this is a case where you can look back and say, should we have done things differently? And unfortunately, she ended up going into septic shock and multiple organ dysfunction syndrome. And she ended up dying. And so these are post-mortem pictures of her wounds. And so in this case, it wasn't her wounds as such at the end that killed her, as in the breakdown infection of the wounds, it was severe systemic response to having large open areas of wound and huge protein loss through these wounds. So essentially, as I mentioned, like a large burns victim. And so this is a case you kind of ask yourself, should we have done something differently day one as regards should we have done a different type of dressing or intervened and closed earlier to try and stop this massive protein loss and negative energy balance. So this is a case that didn't turn out well. Now, most of these do turn out well, but unfortunately not this one. And so if we have a look at some of these trauma cases, when we have severe trauma, we know that there's two peaks of mortality in both humans and animals. We have an early peak of mortality, which is where we intervene early. So in this case, I intervened early and did multiple anesthetics. So she had an anesthetic every day for 5 days. And so we have a risk of them dying from their injuries early, but then later on we have them a risk of them dying from decompensating from all of the interventions we've done. So we tend to have these two peaks of mortality. And this most likely is due to what we call this two-hit phenomenon. So the first hit being the trauma, then we get systemic inflammation, and then hopefully the body deals with it and you recover and life goes on. However, in some of these patients, the first hit or trauma is so bad that they immediately go into organ dysfunction or acute respiratory distress syndrome, and that's the significant problem. However, what we're talking about in this patient is the second hit phenomenon. And that's where an endogenous or exogenous stimulator, so for example, general anesthesia would be an exogenous second hit. It's putting a patient through hypothermia, putting him through just quite a significant imbalance, and that can result in increasing systemic inflammation. And if we're lucky, they go on to recover, but if we're not, we can actually push them into MODS or ARDS and lose them that way. So it's just important to remember, in some of these trauma patients, getting the timing of surgery is hard. That patient needed surgery immediately. However, the cumulative effect of multiple anesthetics along with her trauma likely didn't help her scenario. So let's look briefly at complicated bite wounds. And these are ones that enter the thorax or the abdominal cavity, for example, exposing viscera or leading to loss of negative pressure, for example, in the thorax. If we have a look at some of these cases, if we look at neck wounds, 25% of them have an injury to a vital structure, and 17% of those were airway injuries, all small dogs in that case series of 56 cases back from 2013. You can also see neck or central nervous system injuries as well. We typically do see quite a few neck injuries with sub-Q or mediastinal emphysema, and we don't worry about that unless it's causing respiratory difficulty. But other injuries we can see are the jugular vein, the pharynx, the esophagus, and spine. Interestingly, in this case series, there was only a 4% mortality rate. And I have to say, whether I'm doing something wrong, I tend to see a little bit higher mortality rate in these cases, especially when they have severe trauma. And that might be something to do with the case selection I see in specialist practice, that we tend to see the more significant ones. But certainly I would expect slightly higher mortality rates than this. So thoracic bite wounds tend to have minor skin wounds. However, they often have large areas of devitalized tissue. They often have fractured ribs, sternebrae. They may have flail chest, meaning that we have segments of ribs that are free-floating. And so when the animal breathes in, they can suck in those segments of ribs towards the chest. And when they breathe out, they're pushed out, so leading to paradoxical breathing. We can see pneumothorax quite commonly. And we can have damage to the internal viscera, so lungs, for example. And back from 2002 in this study looking at bite wounds, those that did end up dying, they did tend more likely to have thoracic wounds than those that didn't die. Some things to consider with bite wounds into the thorax is to temporarily seal any leaking penetration, so you can hear sometimes sucking wounds. Temporarily seal them off with lubricating jelly and maybe apply a small dressing to them. In some of these cases, to get them stable, you may need to immediately intubate them, and you may immediately need to evacuate the chest either via thoracocentesis or by placing a chest tube. In that scenario, using the Myola very small bore over the wire chest tubes is very useful, rather than going for a trocar style chest tube. You need to be prepared to mechanically ventilate these patients. And the question then is, should you go to surgery or not? And it depends. And there's two schools of thought. And if you were to ask 100 specialists, you get probably 50% in one camp and 50% in the other. What we know is we don't know enough. We don't have enough evidence to say they should all go to surgery or not. Contamination isn't as big a deal in the thorax as it is in the abdomen. So we can deal with a pyothorax later on. And are they so systemically compromised? Will they survive an anaesthetic if we do one straight away? So right now it's very case dependent and specialist dependent as to whether you should intervene straight away or whether you should manage these conservatively and then intervene later if you need to. Abdominal bite wounds are a little more clear cut because there's a high risk of injury to the gastrointestinal tract. And obviously, if that is left unchecked, that will lead to septic peritonitis and death. And so it's a little easier to justify taking these patients to surgery if you're highly suspicious of injury to the gastrointestinal tract. The key here is to remember you won't always see a pneumoperitoneum, so making that decision can be tricky. So you might use ultrasound to look for free fluid and analyze that fluid by doing an abdominal syntesis and cytology. You might do a diagnostic peritoneal lavage. I think the key part here is if in doubt, you probably need to recommend exploring. And those that died in this study from 2002 were 10 times more likely to have abdominal wounds in that case series. So let's look at bite wounds involving a body cavity. This is a 6-month-old female spayed domestic shorthair who presented actually 36 hours to our hospital after being assessed what was suspected to be a bite wound. So she was found collapsed in her driveway, went to a regular vet. They saw this puncture wound, didn't think too much of it, and she was responding to treatment, and she was referred on when she decompensated. So some key parts here is we have what looks like a fairly innocuous puncture wound right here, but we have very extensive bruising all over the abdomen and the chest. So in this case, we're worried about both the thorax and abdomen. So she had thoracic radiographs performed, and we can see that we seem to have an increased fluid opacity. We can't really see the cardiac silhouette very well on this radiograph. And then if we have a look at this radiograph, we have a low volume pneumothorax as well. So most likely something has involved the thorax in this case. And here we can see on the right hand side, we have a low volume pneumothorax. We have some pleural fluid, and then we also have consolidation of the right cranial and right middle lung lobes. And so certainly there's concern about something involving that right hemithorax over which the puncture wound was located. She had an abdominal ultrasound, again, given the degree of bruising over the abdomen, and there was a small amount of free abdominal fluid. Here we can see what was identified as a very small gallbladder, and then the fluid was obtained by abdominal syntesis and came back as just a transudate, so nothing concerning in the abdomen. So the next thing that was noticed was that this fluid coming out of this wound was very copious and yellow-tinged. And so this was tested, and it turns out that the bilirubin was extremely high in it, and her peripheral bilirubin was normal. And so the concern now is we have a puncture wound, what looks like over the thorax, with bile coming out of it, which is an extremely rare presentation. So she ended up going for an exploratory laparotomy, extending through the diaphragm into the thorax to see what was going on. And here what we have, just to orient you, this is the front of the cat, so the head is up here. Tail is down here. We've opened the abdomen, and here we are looking at a bilobed gallbladder. So there's one intact lobe of the gallbladder here, and here we have a not intact part of the gallbladder. So bilobed gallbladder is reasonably common in cats. So we have part of the gallbladder that's avulsed. This actually had been located through a tear in the diaphragm, and it was stuck up against that puncture wound in the wall. So that's why bile was leaking out of the puncture wound directly from this piece of gallbladder. So the bite had come from this area down to here, crushed and dragged the gallbladder up through the diaphragm and against the thoracic wall. So we did have bile actually in the thorax itself around the lungs and consolidated lung lobes. But luckily for this cat, it was leaking mostly out of the chest, and there was no contamination of the peritoneal space at all. So extremely rare scenario, to the point where we actually wrote this up as a case report in the Journal of Feline Medicine and Surgery. So we would call this a traumatic isolated bilothorax, just bile leaking into the thoracic space and not into the peritoneal space. But it just shows you as a good example of how what looked like a very innocuous puncture wound over a body cavity can certainly be anything but an innocuous puncture wound. And this cat went on to do very well. So let's move on briefly in the last few minutes to other penetrating injuries. And the reason I'm spending less time on these is we do see less of them by far. We see mostly bite wounds, but certainly you can see some good ones like this steak knife in a chest. I'm not sure what the dog did to deserve a steak knife in his chest. And then we can see quite striking things like this impalement of a heart. And so this is a dog that impaled himself on a stick. And the tempting thing when you see these things walk into the emergency room is to pull that stick out. And obviously, if you had done that in this case, you would lead to catastrophic hemorrhage and death. So a couple of tips and tricks for dealing with actual penetrating foreign bodies like sticks or knives or other ballistics. The key is to resist the temptation to pull it out, because you run the risk of you pull it out uncontrolled, you may have uncontrolled hemorrhage that then you have to do an emergency surgery to deal with. So resist the temptation to just pull out the foreign body in the emergency room. Get some imaging with the foreign body in place if you can, whether that be an x-ray, whether it be a CT scan, if you have one available. And this can try to give you some information as to what structures the foreign object is involved with. Then you want to cut it near to the body surface and then clip and clean, just like we talked about for the bite wounds, clip and clean around the entry and exit wounds. And then also prepare, for example, if you're having to go into a body cavity to get it out, then you're going to want to clip and clean those areas too. You're going to want to assess what damage this has done in the body cavity. So, for example, you might do an exploratory laparotomy. You might do a median sternotomy for the chest. Have a look in there and see what structures are involved, for example, heart, lung. And under visualization, you can then remove the foreign body when you can see exactly what's going to happen. And you can intervene quickly if you have profuse hemorrhage. So, for example, with that heart, you might have pre-placed a purse string suture around the stick in the surrounding tissue so that when you pull the stick out, you can quickly stop hemorrhage with direct pressure. So let's look at a case example. This is Arrow, unfortunately named because that's how he came in. And this is a cat that I saw when I was working in Florida. And he had been struck, obviously, through what looked like the thoracic cavity with an arrow through and through about 8 days prior to presentation to us. And so they'd been trying to trap him. He was a wild cat and he wouldn't fit in the trap because of the arrow. Every time he tried to get in, he got stuck. So it took them 8 days to catch him, which is quite interesting. So they managed to catch him. He was brought in anaesthetized from his local vet. And we can see, obviously, this arrow going through what looks like the thoracic cavity. So we can see the exit wound here and then the entry wound here. So what do we do with this case? So again, just some more views of these wounds. So it looks like it's somewhere at the border between the thorax and the abdomen. So it could be involving any of these structures. So we need to be prepared to explore both the chest and the abdomen in this case, or both at the same time. And so what we started with was get the cat stable under anesthesia, clip clean, and of course in these cases you probably also need to take forensic photographs in case there is any lawsuit from this. And so in this case we had a forensic team in the university and they came and documented all of these injuries. So he was taken to surgery. He had a median sternotomy to start with because we'd done a CT scan that showed us that the injury was mostly through the thorax. It had just avoided the abdomen. But if we hadn't had that information, I would have explored the abdomen as well by extending the median sternotomy down through the ventral midline. So here we can see this is the head of the cat up here. And then this is the tail of the cat. So we are looking down median sternotomy. The heart has been gently reflected off here. And here we can see this arrow coming through. And it had just caught one of the lung lobes, but just missed the diaphragm. And as I said, just caught a lung lobe on the way through. And so he ended up just needing a partial lung lobectomy. And then the arrow was removed quite easily under visualization. We did the partial lung lobectomy using a stapling device. And that cat went on to make a full recovery. So you can get lucky with these cases if they avoid major structures. You can have a very good outlook. So to wrap up, what would be the prognosis for many of these penetrating injuries? It really depends on what kind of injury you're dealing with, how long it's been to presentation. Overall, we can say for bite wounds, the survivals are pretty good, 70 to 80%, but it really is dependent on how significant the trauma is and relative to the size of the patient also. If we have a look at overall penetrating wounds, survival rates look to be close to 90%, but a more recent study looking at military dogs that had received gunshot wounds are much lower in these cases. So my take-home messages from this webinar presentation would be to be careful to evaluate the whole patient before you jump into dealing with some of these wounds and come up with a careful plan of do you need to explore a body cavity or not. With simple bite wounds and complicated bite wounds, early intervention is key. We know that the longer intervention is delayed, the higher the risk of infection. I would consider delayed wound closure in many of these contaminated wounds, especially if I feel like my first debridement hasn't been enough. Rather than close even over a drain, I'd consider dressing and coming back sequentially every day until the wound is healthy enough to close. As we mentioned, the prognosis is generally fairly good. Most of these patients recover, but we don't win them all, unfortunately. All right, and I'll hand back to Emer.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Laura for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.